And you don't even have the spare real estate in the corner that is your kitchen to stock some box wine, because the container is literally too big for your fridge. I was 22 years old at the time and couldn't afford the rent on my own, so I put an ad on Craigslist for a roommate. Yes, a roommate, in a studio apartment. Hey, I said I wanted cozy, right? This was it. This is a reality that many New Yorkers have lived. The apartment was maybe about 30 feet by 20 feet, and it was filthy when I moved in. My mom and I scrubbed it clean and decorated it cute. I made the bed with my favorite sheets, and I was in heaven that it was mine. I got a response to my Craigslist ad from a girl named Brittany, who was from the South and coming to the city for art school. We spoke on the phone once, and she moved in. I know this sounds like the setup to a shitty horror movie, but she was sweet and clean, and we got along great. We never fought. We couldn't afford cable, but we had a little TV, so we watched DVDs of Sex and the City and Will and Grace. Now that I think of it, it may have been the best time of my life. After paying rent, I could barely afford to eat. Fortunately, we lived in Chinatown, where food can be very cheap. There was a dumpling factory right around the corner from us, and for $5, you could get a huge bag of them, enough to eat for a week. I ate a record-breaking number of dumplings that year. No nutrition, but delicious. My face would swell and lips would blister from the salt, because the only way to consume them is by drowning them in high-sodium soy sauce. The price of real estate, or just the price of rent, in this city can really warp your judgment. Rent is so high and good places are so scarce that sometimes you talk yourself into very bad ideas. Case in point, when I moved back in with Dan after the blackout of 2003, I told myself that my instinct to make it work with an abusive ex had nothing to do with his nice two-bedroom apartment. But of course it did. Not that I wasn't enjoying folding my Murphy bed into the wall every night. It was a great way to kill the bugs in there and have space to lie on the floor and cry. Dan was living with his friend Rob at the time, in Murray Hill. Both he and his roommate were children of privilege who could always rely on some rich relative to give them dough when the going got tough. But they had no jobs and no money of their own. The neighborhood was vile, home to young corporate America, shitty bars playing shitty classic rock and shitty white kids drinking their parents' money away. I'd take the subway to work and sling ribeyes all day at the steakhouse in Grand Central Terminal, while Dan would do God knows what. He tried his best to be reliably sane for a while, but he eventually started acting nuts again and was scaring me. Remember, this was the same boyfriend who pulled a knife on me. I knew it was dangerously stupid to continue living with him, but instead of moving out myself, I convinced him to move home with his mom, which wasn't a tough sell because she happened to be a kind person with a dope-ass apartment. Right at the same time, Rob had been invited to travel around Europe with a cousin, but he didn't want to go and leave his girlfriend Mary behind. But Mary was sick of him and was eyeing the apartment, so she convinced him to go. After both boys left, Mary and I lived there alone. I remember the day Dan and Rob were both officially out of the house. Mary and I jumped on our beds like little girls to celebrate our healthy relationship decisions and getting them out of our lives. But mostly I think we were delighted at how funny it was that we'd evicted our boyfriends from their own apartment. The bottom line to this sad story is that I would have done anything to be able to live in the city I loved. And even though anything included making a regrettable choice with a dude, I still take it as a good sign that I was persistent enough to fight my way from one gross overpriced domicile to the next. I was always pushing and struggling for the easiest setup and the cheapest rent. I once shared an apartment with a married couple in Brooklyn who needed a roommate to make rent. Or so they said. They'd give me lots of attention and make me feel really wanted, but I soon figured out it was because they didn't want to be alone together anymore. I see now that my presence was meant to distract them from their impending divorce. Some couples have a kid to try to save their marriage. These two had a 20-something waiter / stand-up / actress who ate more than her fair share of pantry items she didn't purchase. Their tactic didn't work and they eventually split up. But they helped me get by for a while. So shout out to that couple who prevented me from having to move back in with my mom or eject myself to the suburbs. I'd also like to give a shout out to the single lady roommate who descended the stairs completely naked from the waist down, sometimes to get attention from my boyfriend. Here's to the old guy who was still living in my new apartment on the day I moved in. My roommate and I had to pack all of his clothing and box up his huge collection of vintage nudie magazines. One of them featured a girl wearing a varsity sweater, and she looked so much like me. The magazine was called Babyface. I was flattered there was a market for girls like me, who resemble that 80s doll kid sister or one of the Garbage Pail Kids. Oh, and one more very special shout-out goes to the roommate who invited exactly one-third of Manhattan to our place for a Halloween party, which ended when I found an aggressive dude ass-fucking a woman in a cowgirl costume in my unlocked bathroom. All in all, the common thread in my sad string of NYC apartments is that I put up with a lot of vermin and weirdness and coziness so I could be where I wanted to be. I believe you should fight for what you want. I'm proud of almost every housing decision I made in the sense that they kept me in the city where I needed to be. I wouldn't have made it this far as a comedian or human if I hadn't stayed there. I guess I only strayed from this pattern when I would get distracted by a guy, and moving became a dating tactic. A not very sly, but surprisingly effective dating tactic. Besides, the aforementioned time I moved back in with Dan, I set up a real nice home life with my boyfriend Rick when I was 25. He wasn't at all ready for us to live together, but that didn't stop me from pressuring him to let me move in with him. I've lived with 4 boyfriends in my life, and I've tricked each of them into it. It always ended poorly. I don't think I even wanted to live with Rick, but I wanted him to want to live with me. Being a woman is so fun! Anyway, Rick and I lived together in Brooklyn in a small but not completely horrible one-bedroom apartment. We'd work hard all day at our respective restaurant and office temp jobs, and then I'd do a stand-up show at night, which I was just starting at the time. Around 10 p.m., one of us would make dinner, then we'd watch a movie we'd gotten in the mail from Netflix, we'd drink wine, smoke pot, and eat ice cream. The fridge was big enough to house all of these things. It was heaven. What more is there to life than being stoned and full and having sex, unless, of course, you're too full? Anyway, after living together for a while, Rick and I were in love and really excited about each other. We would make each other laugh and gaze into each other's eyes, and it felt like life was going to be all right. But I was with him during a big turning point in my life, when I got the full-blown comedy disease, which I told you about in How to Become a Stand-Up Comedian. I had it bad, and the only cure was to get on the road and do more comedy. I couldn't imagine putting anything else first in my life, not even a guy I loved. I was also learning that I was an introvert, one of the first things I told you about myself in this book, who worked best when she had large spans of time to herself. So even though the fake married life was nice for a while, I realized it wasn't for me, at least not in that moment in time. After we broke up, when I was on Last Comic Standing, I basically lived on the road for a while. You'd think I would have learned my lesson about living with a guy, but not too long after, I became infatuated with this hot dude from my acting class, Devin, and eventually ended up moving to Astoria just to trap him into dating me. Which worked! But the joke was on me. Not only did I move into the worst part of Queens, but I also got bedbugs, the 9/11 of bugs, which provide both a logistical and existential nightmare when they come into your life. They are nearly impossible to get rid of. So I had to subject my poor, elderly stuffed animals to a scary ride in a high-heat dryer. And everyone I knew was quietly reevaluating their friendship with me. This is not an exaggeration, and it's another classic New York story. Some people will straight up take you out of their phones when they learn you have been hit with this plague. But bedbugs aside, there are many beautiful places in Astoria, just not where I lived. I went to the grossest carpeted gym of all time there. It was billed as being just for women, which almost always is code for subpar. The whole thing was built on a slant, so when you'd run on the treadmill, one leg would take all the weight. There were a lot of Muslim women in the neighborhood, and they would be on the ellipticals in their burqas while their husbands sat in the lobby area waiting for them to finish their workouts, staring at the rest of us while they waited. I've been more comfortable getting a pelvic exam from a gynecologist with Parkinson's. Amy, that is unsympathetic to people with that horrible disease, and now we are mad and writing about it on message boards. Okay, you're right. I'm sorry. But relax. My first ever gyno actually had Parkinson's, and it was awful. He was 1 million years old, and I found out that he had died when I went in for one of my annual checkups. The new guy told me the news while his fingers were inside me and my ovaries were being squished. The previous sentence is also the title of my next book. In defense of the Rick and Devin situations, I think there is a lot to be said for just picking up your things and moving to the neighborhood of the guy you like. When you're a child, you're friends with people based on proximity, and I've found it's the same for men. That's why so many of them sleep with their nannies, because they're there! And besides, I'm still great friends with both of these guys. They're both amazing actors, and Devin Dane, haha, his real name is Kevin Kane, has become my working partner in everything I do. I feel like I could write a whole book on all the gross, weird places I've lived and all the bizarre or wonderful roommates I've had. Each place was just a temporary stop on the road to getting me where I wanted to be. I never quit moving, and I didn't bother getting too comfortable because I wanted to be ready for whatever came next. Now that I finally own a place, maybe I will stay for a while. I have everything I need. I even live near a small body of water where I like to do my preferred form of exercise. A long geriatric walk while nibbling on a scone. And guys, I got a wine refrigerator for my kitchen. Is that not relatable? Have I sold out from my days of drinking single-serving box wine with a straw? No, because I still drink those too. It's just that I recently learned that I drink my Chardonnay too cold, and I didn't even know that was possible. But now I am dedicating my life to correcting that error. Anyway, as long as I'm in this city, not too far from my second home, the Comedy Cellar, I'm happy. I suspect I will never stop moving. Literally, I might live in a few hundred more apartments, but they will always be on the same island of Manhattan, and I will continue to circle this same pond over and over again, until I am an elderly woman. I know there are probably bigger, better bodies of water in L.A., but I'm pretty sure it's illegal to transport a baked good from one location to another there. Can you imagine walking into a Beverly Hills SoulCycle with a fistful of quiche? I have to do that sometime. But even if they were cool with it, L.A. would never feel like home to me. Blackouts and stem cells. I pay my taxes, I vote, for my favorite reality show contestants, but also in elections. I call my friends on their birthdays, I use a bath towel no longer than a week before washing it, I drink the recommended amount of water daily, and I can hold my liquor. All of this makes me a grown-up. Actually, as I write this, my 24-year-old assistant just brought me a snack of crackers and hummus, so maybe I still have some work to do. But when I was in college, I was a far cry from adulthood. I did none of the things listed above. By junior year of college, this is how I drank. I'd have 2 beers in my dorm room, then go to the bar, where I'd enjoy about 4 martinis. 4 real martinis. I'm talking Kettle One up and dirty. And I would always go back to the bartender and complain that they'd made it too dirty, so I could get more vodka added for free. Everyone else ordered normal college stuff, like vodka cranberries or Jack and Cokes. But it was always beer and martinis for me. And then, sometimes I'd end the night with some wine or champagne, even though I had nothing to celebrate. As it turns out, I also won the genetic lottery and I'm one of those chicks who is prone to blackouts! For those of you who haven't been to high school or college parties, blacking out is when your mind goes to sleep but your body keeps right on doing whatever your drunk-ass self thinks is a good idea. Blacking out is not passing out asleep in a drunken stupor. It's quite the opposite. Your brain is sleeping like an innocent little baby, but your body is at a rave and it keeps making decisions. Decisions such as, let's eat something called a walking taco from a place in Chicago where you eat a taco mixed in a Fritos bag and jam handfuls of it in your mouth. This is why blacking out is incredibly dangerous. You might look like a regular drunk girl, but you're actually a zombie who won't remember shit later. A really thrilling part of blacking out is the fact that sometimes you wake up while you're still doing whatever horrible thing you chose to do when you fell into it. You suddenly reemerge in your body like a time traveler and have no idea how long you've been out. My most memorable, technically my least memorable, college blackout happened this way. My brain was completely checked out, and then all of a sudden, I was back in my body and aware of everything. I looked southward, and there was a stranger going down on me in my bed. Huh? What? Hello? I'll say that again. Someone I had never in my life met or seen before was tonguing my vagina like he was digging for gold. I had a boyfriend at the time, and this was not him. I didn't know this dude, but he was obviously getting to know me. I lightly tapped him on the shoulder, because I didn't want to startle him, and also because what do I know about this guy at this point? Obviously, I know he is a true gentleman. He's going down on me, and that is a move worthy of knighthood. On my vagina's very best day, when I know I may have a visitor soon, so I've just showered and really tended to it with care, it still smells like a small barnyard animal. A freshly washed goat or something of that size and potency. A cute one that you'd want to buy little pellets for and feed at a zoo. That's on its best day. On its worst day, after a night of drinking, it's probably like an unwashed shark tank. I imagine going down on me after a night on the town must be like Indiana Jones entering some sort of a cobwebbed room where he'll need to choose a cup wisely. This saint-like man looked up at me after I tapped him. He was hot, so I patted myself on the back and thought, nice job, Shooms. He looked up, but stayed down there, and for a minute, it looked like I was giving birth to him. I said, hi, I'm Amy. I don't believe we've had the pleasure. He was very confused. As gently as I could, I explained what had happened. He left pretty quick. I stormed into my roommate Denise's room and asked, why did you let me bring some random guy home? You know I have a boyfriend. She was in shock and immediately defended herself. Apparently, I hadn't even seemed very drunk and had walked around the bar with this guy all night, our arms around each other like we were a couple. Denise assumed I had consciously made the choice to be with this guy and ditch my boyfriend. I literally didn't remember meeting him. I saw him a few years later in a bar and apologized profusely. He seemed a bit unnerved, but tried to pretend like he didn't mind. Knowing what he'd encountered between my legs that night, I'm guessing he was probably thrilled to have received such an easy get-out-of-jail-free card for me. He probably shuddered at the sight of me and started having sudden memory flashes of deep-sea fishing and an old sunken ship covered in plankton and kelp. I'm not ashamed of this either. Vaginas are supposed to look and smell like vaginas. Keep your strange, scented washes away from me, women's magazines. I'll allow my vag to keep its natural aroma of chicken noodle soup. Thank you very much. There were other notable blackouts during college, like the time I ate an entire Papa John's pizza, or when I ditched a cab and skinned my hands running from it. I also once went home with some dude who owned more than 2 pit bulls, which is the reddest flag there is. And my sister still loves to remind me about the time I put her in a car with strangers so I could stay out longer. My blackouts have usually involved eating like it's my last meal, but the time my brain went night-night while I let a stranger wake up my unwashed vagina definitely still gets the top prize. I want to encourage any young lady reading this to avoid drinking to the point where you're unsafe, especially if you have this cool genetic quirk and are prone to blacking out. It's crazy unsafe, and I lucked out with a nice dude who treated my vagina area like a golden corral. But let's get back to the part about how I'm a seasoned, smart adult now. I drink wine and scotch fairly regularly. Sometimes a martini or tequila, just to mix it up, but not excessively. And I definitely don't drink to the point of blackout. Not only did college Amy teach me a lesson, I truly don't enjoy being drunk anymore. I'm not recommending dead sobriety here. I mean, don't be cray. But I don't like to get anything more than a little tipsy now. I'm in a really good place and have gotten my behavior under major control. Guys, I blacked out a few months ago. I'm not proud of this. I don't think it's cute or even funny. But sometimes when a sad and complicated set of circumstances lands you in the emotional and physical gutter, all you can do is laugh. After you cry. And drink. It all started when a woman named Meg went to see Trainwreck with her friend. Meg has multiple sclerosis and didn't know MS would be such a large part of the movie, but ended up really liking the fact that it was included in the story. She reached out to me because she said she wanted to hook my dad up with an incredible doctor in New York who had helped her. Dr. Sadiq is the only doctor in the U.S. who is FDA approved to treat MS patients with stem cells. To me, the idea that my dad could feel better wasn't even in the realm of possibility. I was grateful to Meg and excited for my dad to meet Dr. Sadiq. But I also didn't want to get my hopes up too high. Over the years, I'd noticed a change in my dad's willingness to take his meds and follow doctor's recommendations. He's offered physical therapy several times a week in the facility where he lives, but he was going infrequently or sometimes not at all. I sent an acupuncturist to him for a few months, and without telling me, he told her to stop coming. One day, a couple years ago, we got into an argument about it, which ended with his shouting that he just didn't want to try anymore. This crushed me. Realizing that he'd thrown in the towel and wanted to passively allow the disease to do what it would broke my heart. People with MS deal with a lot. Difficulty with eating, walking, and controlling their bowels, as has been well documented in this book. Not to mention the toll it takes on cognitive abilities and emotional stability. My dad was never the kind of guy to have a hopeful outlook on life. He was always dark. Even in his heyday, when he was young, rich, and handsome, He could make Tim Burton seem like Richard Simmons. But this was different. He was telling me to back off and let him decay. I don't blame my dad for wanting to give up, but it still destroyed me to hear him say it. Since then, I've been mourning my dad while he's still alive. One certainty of MS is that his physical abilities will decline more and more until they're entirely gone. This has led us to experience a lot of lasts together. The most heartbreaking one was the last time we went body surfing. We'd always loved riding the ocean waves together. So when it became clear that he wasn't going to be able to walk much longer, he asked me to go to the beach with him one last time. It was a pretty cloudy day, and there was a chill in the air. There were only one or two other people on the beach. I put on a brave face as we walked into the ocean. The waves were rough enough that you had to use your leg strength to make it in past the break. He struggled. It was crushing me to see him getting knocked down. I let us in and turned my face out to the ocean horizon so my dad wouldn't notice my heart falling out of my chest and into the sea. Seeing your parent physically incapable like that is something I wish on no one. We waited for a good wave, the last wave we would ever ride together. When we saw it rolling in, we made eye contact and nodded to each other like musicians agreeing to play the bridge. We bent our knees, leaned toward the shore with our arms over our heads, and dove. It was a long, hard wave, and we rode it all the way in. We could feel the power of the ocean carrying us. When we stopped, I picked up my head to see where my father was. He was right next to me, squinting through the salt water and wiping the hair out of his eyes. He looked over at me and we smiled big at each other, bugging our eyes out to keep each other from bawling. I took his hand and helped him walk back until the wet sand turned dry. We caught our breath and tried not to take in the gravity of the moment. I never wanted to give up hope that he could someday go out there again. But none of the MS studies I'd ever read made this seem possible. So I decided that instead of trying to heal him, I'd do whatever I could to make his time on Earth as pleasurable and comfortable as possible. If he asked me to bring him 500 Werther's Original hard candies to suck on incessantly, I would. If he wanted booze, even though he never asked me, I'd get it for him. If he asked me for pot cookies, which he did, I'd bring them. I'd do anything for my dad. Buy him a lap dance, a lap dog, whatever it took. So when I received Meg's email about Dr. Sadiq, I thought about the promise I'd made to my dad to let him be. And I thought, fuck him, he's going to see this doctor. I didn't care if he had to be brought in on a stretcher kicking and screaming. Well, he can't kick, so just screaming. I didn't even ask him. I just told him he was going to see this special doctor and made it sound exciting and magical, as if it were something to look forward to. And he bit. The next day, he traveled the 2 hours from Long Island to meet Kim and me at Dr. Sadiq's office in Manhattan. It's always a gamble what version of my father I will get. The medication can often make him out of it and kind of mean. But when he got off the elevator at the doctor's office that day, he was smiling and didn't say anything hostile to the staff. My dad can be a huge wise-ass who lashes out in a funny way at people. But sometimes it's altogether unfunny and just unkind. I've seen him scream at very gentle, nice orderlies who are just trying to help him back into his chair. He is rude to nurses, dismissive and cold if they're lucky, and flirty and aggressive if they aren't. But that day, he didn't make inappropriate eye or ass contact with the nursing staff. At one point, when the nurse asked who was older, Kim or me, he answered, "The big one," as he pointed at me. But other than that fun insult, things were looking up. My dad and I held hands as Dr. Sadiq explained what the stem cell treatments would entail over the next 6 months. Less than halfway through the conversation, my dad interrupted Dr. Sadiq, who was mid-sentence. "I have to pee." His attendant wheeled him to the bathroom, where he stayed for a very long time, longer than normal by 5 times. The doctor continued while my dad was in the restroom, explaining that the stem cell treatment could at the very least improve him significantly, even potentially making it possible for him to walk again. This was amazing news, of course, but Kim and I must have seemed like we weren't sold, because Dr. Sadiq started offering up references who could testify to the quality of his treatments. "No, doctor, we aren't worried about you," I said. I came right out and admitted that I was afraid my dad would either completely resist the treatment or become so difficult that the doctor would eventually refuse to treat him. Dr. Sadiq, a man so determined and dedicated to his work that he often sleeps in his office, jokingly explained, "Oh, no, I am treating him whether he likes it or not. He can punch me in the face and call me names, and I will not let him get out of this." And then the doctor, in his matter-of-fact way, said something that should have been obvious to me. "Your father doesn't want to get his hopes up." A pang shot through my entire body. Of course. Why didn't I see this myself? It's a huge theme in my own life and even in my movie. Trainwreck is in many ways a love letter to my father. It's my way of saying, even though you have wronged people and made mistakes, I love you, and your life hasn't gone unwitnessed. I wanted him to see himself as I see him, as a human who is sick and flawed, but who I think is pretty wonderful, most of the time. I guess the need to protect yourself to the point of being an asshole runs in the family. My dad and I have both been burned so many times that we use humor and darkness to keep potential pain at bay. I'd been giving my dad such a hard time for his unwillingness to fight his MS, but he was being resistant for good reason. He'd already been beaten to the ground countless times, literally. Kim and I teared up a little and nodded as our dad was rolled back into the room. I squeezed his hand and could tell his mood had soured a little. I held my breath and could not bear to look at my dad. Dr. Sadiq explained every detail of the next 6 months of his life. And while he didn't make it sound easy, he did focus on the results. Throughout the discussion, my dad kept looking at the floor, and Dr. Sadiq would gently reprimand him. "Look at me, Gordon." When he finished his explanation, my dad was looking down again. There was a long silence. We all sat there very still. And then my father looked up and said, "Okay, I will put my hope and faith in you." Kim and I couldn't fucking believe it. Never had I ever heard my dad say the words hope or faith. I think my dad could be at the Wailing Wall or sitting with the Dalai Lama on a mountain in Tibet, and he'd be annoyed that someone next to him was humming too loudly or complaining that he was hungry. What I'm saying is, he's not a spiritual guy. I threw my arms around him and then sat back down before the tears started falling uncontrollably down my face. I leaned over and said, "I'm so proud of you. I love you." It wasn't just that he'd accepted treatment. It was that he still had some hope left in there. We set up our next appointment with Dr. Sadiq and said our goodbyes, and went home to spend the evening with my very kind boyfriend, Ben. I was feeling emotional, but I held it together. We got cozy in the living room, and I explained, "I had a tough day. I want to have some wine tonight." I opened a bottle and had a glass. We started watching the latest episode of Girls, and it was coincidentally about Hannah's father, who was struggling with living his life as a gay man, having just come out of the closet to Hannah. The parent-child roles were reversed, with Hannah coming to his rescue when her father was sad and disoriented. The episode ended with their walking through Times Square together, him sadly saying, "I don't know what to do," and Hannah saying, "That's okay. I'm here, and I'll always be here." Any tears I'd held back in my entire life came out right then and there. The floodgates opened, and I bawled hard. Thank God I'm a very, very pretty crier. Ben was sweet and watched a lot of mucus drain from my nose onto the couch and hugged me after I finally caught my breath. When I was done crying, I drank another glass of wine and took a hit of weed. I wanted the day to end because it was hard enough having all those realizations about my dad, but it was also new to have a boyfriend with me, witnessing the whole thing. Being the child of an alcoholic father, and whatever my mom is, had made me almost incapable of believing that the people I love won't leave me or hurt me in a way I didn't think they were capable of. I have to fight against all of my impulses and warped instincts to accept any sort of love. This night was no exception. It was time to call it a day, and fast. So I took 5 milligrams of Ambien, which is on the higher end of the normal nightly dosage for me, and I started to get ready for bed. My limbs were a little sore from the 11-mile bike ride Ben and I had gone on that morning. Ew, we're an annoying white couple. I was physically and mentally drained, and a little drunk. Throwing Ambien into the mix was not wise, since as I learned the hard way, it enhances the effects of alcohol and vice fucking versa. If the details of what happened next were left to me, I'd tell you that I had one more glass of wine and then woke up the next morning. But according to my loving, patient boyfriend, who was staring forlornly at the ceiling when I opened my eyes the next morning, a lot happened after that last glass of wine. According to Ben, shortly after I prayed to the Holy Trinity of Ambien wine and weed, I began dipping crackers into butter as if it were guacamole. While he watched me in this feeding frenzy, I kept accusing him of judging me. He said I was chasing him around the living room saying, "You're judging me!" with a lot of sass, and he was responding with, "You're getting butter all over the apartment." Then I sat down on the couch to watch television and continue eating my butter mole. I turned on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, his least favorite show, and wouldn't shut up about Khloe and how much she's changed. At least that's what Ben thinks I said, because he could only understand about 30% of my yammering. I ended up heating up 2 frozen pizzas, one of which I burned before he finally convinced me to go to sleep. In bed, I aggressively stacked all the pillows on my side instead of the usual division of 2 and 2. Then I laid my head on top like the princess and the pea. He said, "Amy, we each get 2 pillows," to which I elegantly responded, "Not tonight, motherfucker." Cue the Stevie Wonder song, "Isn't She Lovely?" Anyway, the lesson here is don't combine alcohol, Ambien, and weed on the same day that you take a marathon bike ride, find out your dad's will to live has been restored, and watch a heartbreaking episode of Girls that hits way too close to home. If you learn one thing from this book, let it be that. This blackout at age 34 was a far cry from some of the dangerous situations I got myself into during college. But I still wouldn't recommend that anyone engage in this kind of activity. Not even grown-ups who are in loving, supportive relationships and safely drinking under their own roofs. Ben was pretty generous about the whole thing. He wasn't judgmental or critical, but he was concerned. He didn't like that I decided to check out on him, with good reason. It's not fair, and I haven't done it since. It was a hard couple of years, seeing my dad check out on life like that, knowing that he really meant it when he said he was done trying to improve his condition. A part of me gets it. Things are grim for him most of the time. I'm strong and healthy, and I still have to fight the urge to give up about 3 times a day during award show season. In his younger, healthier days, my dad traveled, partied, philandered, and drank. I know he must miss those times. I feel fortunate I'm still able-bodied enough to make poor choices. Sometimes when I visit him, and he's looking particularly dead-eyed or sad, I try to amp up his spirits, roll him outside for a walk, and get him involved, force him to mix it up. He's still in there when he wants to be, and it's nice to see him. Knowing there's a possibility he will walk again has made everything brighter, and it feels like he's coming back. I push his wheelchair into the fresh air and make him look up at the sky. I watch the sun hit his face and he comes alive, every cell of his body lighting up to cause trouble, just like he was meant to do. An exciting time for women in Hollywood. Imagine you just wrote and starred in your own movie for the first time. The movie premieres, it does well, and you feel like you're on top of the world. And you are exhausted because making a movie is a lot of work, and also because you had to lose and keep off 10 pounds you usually like carrying around with you. Because no woman is believably lovable unless you can see her clavicle from all angles. Then, before you're even done celebrating the premiere of your movie, which you poured your guts into, it's explained to you that actors aren't really paid to act. What they're paid for is to do press. What a gross discovery. I get it. Movies are really expensive to produce, so the studios have to make sure people actually go see them. I apologize if you saw way too much of my face in ads and billboards and commercials in the summer of 2015. If this is how you're feeling, you can thank the marketing people. And trust me, no one was sicker of hearing my voice than I was. I'd never starred in a movie before Trainwreck, so I was virtually unknown in other countries. This meant I had to sign up for an intense international press tour to promote the movie. Press tours consist of visits to multiple cities where you sit in rooms with journalists, usually while on camera, who ask you to talk about your movie so they can go away and write hopefully positive stuff so people will go see your movie. On the press tour, I was interviewed by what felt like every journalist in the world. From the most well-known news stations to dudes who were taping the first episode of their podcast. I had to say yes to everything because the studio was taking a chance on me. I was a new employee, and that is when you have to act excited for the opportunity and be a good little worker bee. When you first hear that you're going to Australia, Germany, London, Amsterdam, Dublin, and on, you think, fuck yeah, free trip. I've never been to Berlin. And then you realize that you will spend every second of every day being asked the same questions by every single interviewer, and you will be expected to perform the answers for them as if they are freshly coming out of your mouth for the first time. Every single time. Without fail, every last one of them asked, how autobiographical is your movie? I started to feel like a soulless show pony. Talking about yourself all day long like that leaves you with a kind of emptiness that's hard to describe. And it's a lot to take on for someone like me who is so unfortunately prone to honesty. On top of feeling like it was up to me to convince people to buy tickets, there was the added burden of being a woman. Because every time there's a female lead in a movie, everyone bugs out and says, will this be a turning point for women? Or what does this mean for women in comedy? So the pressure is on. Because the movie doesn't just have to do well so that I can feel proud of it, or so the studio can make money. It has to do well for the 50% of the population I am now apparently representing. What will this mean for our gender for years to come? That line of questioning is pretty loaded. Especially since this was my first movie, and I don't even pretend to speak for all women. I write about my life and how I see and experience the world, without assuming that my views are universal. So anyway, I went on a huge press tour. Not just for the movie, but for all of female kind. And just like everywhere else, since the dawn of man, every interviewer's favorite question was, is this an exciting time for women in entertainment? Or what does this mean for women in Hollywood? Isn't this an exciting time? And I wanted to scream, no! First of all, I don't consider myself a woman in Hollywood. I'm not even totally sure what that term means. But if I were to play free association with myself and I heard that term, I guess I would think of someone who either has her own abbreviated celeb name, like J-Law/Low, or someone who has looked very hot in a few movies who also, I don't know, has her own lifestyle blog or her own product line, like an Alba or a Paltrow. I have none of those things. Aishu never really caught on like we were all hoping it would. Also, I am literally not a woman in Hollywood. As you know, I've always lived in New York, and no, it doesn't feel like an exciting time. The exciting time will come when nobody has to answer that stupid question. Everyone, on the count of three, stop asking that. Forever. Just stop. 1, 2, 3! And besides, Hollywood is not at all exciting for women. I'm sure no one is too shocked to hear that it's an industry of people who judge most women almost solely on their appearance. And where every day women feel themselves barreling toward death and decay while smaller, hotter actresses like Selena keep appearing like Russian nesting dolls. It's an industry where you go from playing a lead love interest to a turtleneck and knit vest sporting grandmother who, despite missing her husband, still has a lot of love to give to pets. In half the time, a leading man turns into a grandpa. I'm of the belief that in most industries, women have to work twice as hard to get half the credit. After putting in so much effort to make a good movie, it felt pretty demeaning when they called it a female comedy. This meaningless label painted me into a corner and forced me to speak for all females. Because I am the actual female who wrote the female comedy, and then starred as the lead female in that female comedy. They don't ask Seth Rogen to be all men. They don't make men's comedies. They don't ask Ben Stiller, hey Ben, what was your message for all male kind, when you pretended to have diarrhea and chased that ferret in Along Came Polly? On the press tour, many interviewers actually acknowledged this issue and came right out and asked, is there a lot of pressure on you to speak for all women? I appreciated that they got right to it. Maybe it's a good question. I understand that I have enough eyes and ears on me that what I say and do matters. This is a responsibility that I'm honored to have, because it's an opportunity to do my best to help empower women in the only way I know how, by writing a story about a woman from the woman's point of view. Trainwreck was about equal opportunity. Equal opportunity to be a commitment phobe, even if you're a girl. But some of the interviewers were thrown off by this. Many of them asked why I chose to write a role reversal for the guy and the girl. Meaning, why did I make the girl the one who had trouble being vulnerable and the guy the one who wanted more of a commitment? Why was the girl the one who had a bachelor pad and a string of one-night stands, and the guy was the one with a highly respected career and sober lifestyle? Interviewers were always shocked when I explained that I hadn't done this intentionally, but that I wrote something true to my experience. Women get a reputation for being the crazy, overly sensitive ones in relationships. But in my experience, it's the dudes who do that. Not that I and most of my friends aren't sensitive flowers. We just don't invest as much or as quickly in relationships. And we don't get our egos as involved. I'll admit to exaggerating LeBron James's character. We made him overly concerned about his friend's love life, the way girls are often characterized. And this is something I haven't actually witnessed from my male friends. But that is where the gender role reversal begins and ends in Trainwreck. I was writing what felt honest, real, and compelling, coming from my perspective and my real life. And even though I'm not going to cop to representing all women, I'm also pretty sure I'm not the only chick with these experiences. Nonetheless, the slut-shaming was off the charts. Maybe it was just a cultural thing that made the foreign journalists seem out of line. Some interviewers brought this vibe. Well, you talk about sexual subject matter in your movie, so I can say anything I want to you. Which made me want to shower for the rest of my life. One of the interviews I did in Australia went viral when the journalist asked me the question, "So your character is a skank. Do you have a word for skank in America?" I told him that it was a rude question, and we went back and forth a little bit. And of course, if you do anything other than just smile and nod and thank them for their time, if you actually have an unfavorable or emotional response to a rude question, the shit hits the fan. People react as if you obviously can't take the heat and need to get out the kitchen. But I've never been a smile and nod type of girl, nor have I ever been one to leave the kitchen. The worst experience was in Berlin. Surprise, surprise! When I sat with the same interviewer twice. He was a man in his late 50s or early 60s, wearing jeans and a button-down. He was balding up top and was letting it grow a little long in the back, half pageboy, half Robert Plant. He wore glasses and didn't let social norms pressure him into smiling, ever. I first sat with him and Bill Hader. He asked Bill if he liked playing a doctor, and then he asked me what I was like to have sex with. Bill didn't like this question and stood up for me. But I said it was fine and explained that it was like being with one of those performers who stand on boxes on street corners spray-painted entirely silver. You can't tell if they're statues or not, but every couple minutes they move slightly. The only difference, I said, is that no one ever gave me a dollar. I need to amend this at this time and say that since then my boyfriend did, very generously slip a dollar under my door once after sex. I sat on the toilet and watched it make its way into the bathroom as I waited until my body agreed to pee so I wouldn't get a UTI. I stared at that dollar feeling loved. That same Berlin interviewer was for some reason allowed to come back later and interview me again, this time with Vanessa Bayer, who plays my friend and coworker in Trainwreck. He was immediately abrasive and started asking me things that seemed to express not only his dislike for the movie, but also for every breath I had ever taken. He said these exact words, "Why do you think it's okay to make people uncomfortable?" As he said this, I caught sight of a large hole in the crotch of his pants and realized that not one, but both of his testicles were exposed. I looked him in the eye and said, "I don't want to embarrass you, but I would like you to cover your lap." Vanessa looked down and saw and nodded while her face turned bright red. She concurred that his balls were like the answer, my friend, blown in the wind. He looked down, crossed his legs, regained his composure, and said, "Where was I?" I said, "You were asking me why I thought it was okay to make people uncomfortable." After the 300th interview talking about how many people I'd slept with and then awkwardly transitioning to my dad's illness, I thought, fuck this, I'm never doing a movie again. Just kidding. I am going to make more movies, but I'll never do that much press again. And I'll never lose weight again. Well, not that much anyway. I look stupid skinny. My large Cabbage Patch head stays the same size and the rest of me shrinks to a different proportion. And what's the reward? To be a woman in Hollywood? No, thank you. Then again, maybe what it means to be a woman in Hollywood is to be one of the many angry, bemused, and ravenous women who just wanted to be actors or artists, and who were made to believe that this option would actually be available to them after they jumped through 5,000 hoops in high school and college and in the gross offices of agents and managers and the quiet church basements where they performed one-act plays and musicals within an inch of their lives. Maybe a woman in Hollywood is just a person who is going about her business and trying to live her dreams, the same as all her male counterparts. But along the way she got held up, hungry and exhausted, by fending off insane double standards and stupid-ass questions from journalists. If that's a woman in Hollywood, then fine, maybe I am one. Guilty as charged. But even though the foreign press couldn't be more wrong about the exciting time all us women in Hollywood are having, not all journalists misunderstood me in my movie. I was so grateful I got nominated for a Golden Globe, which is determined by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. The night of the Golden Globes was a dream. My whole family came with me, and even though I didn't win, I was lucky enough to lose to a friend whose work blows my mind. Some of the journalists from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association who were there that night were amazing. I spoke with many of them and left the interviews feeling nourished, grateful, and understood. Maybe I wasn't just a train wreck of a girl after all. I started to feel better and comforted myself by trying to see myself through their eyes, remembering some of the kind things they'd said to me. But I was promptly brought right back down to earth when I saw how Trainwreck had been renamed in some of the foreign markets. Italy, a disaster girl. Bulgaria, total damage. Czech Republic, derailment. Russia, a girl without complexes. Germany, dating queen. Finland, just the night. Portugal and Poland, derailed. Hungary, disaster. France, crazy Amy. French Canada, hopeless case. Argentina, this girl is a mess. So since I didn't win the Golden Globe that night and get to stand at the podium to make a speech, I want to take this opportunity to thank all the journalists in all the different countries I visited. First, I'd like to thank all the people who pointed out that I was a woman. Your compliments were phrased very precisely so that I was never just described as funny, but rather a funny woman. You made sure I didn't lose sight of my ovaries. Thank you. Without your constant reminders, I may have just forgotten my uterus on a crosstown bus. But you guys made me perpetually aware that I bleed once a month and I can tell a joke. I also want to thank the guy who called me a skank. I could see how unhappy you were in your own life, and I deeply felt for you. If you're out there, I want you to know that I am very happy and experiencing a good time in my life. And lastly, I want to especially thank the balls of that journalist in Berlin. If it weren't for you guys, I would probably be able to sleep at night. And who the hell wants that? Auf Wiedersehen! Macy and Jillian. It was July 23rd, 2015, and Trainwreck had been out for about a week. I was so happy to be home, having just landed in Los Angeles after spending the aforementioned week doing very tiring press for the movie, this time in Australia. It was especially sweet to be home since that trip had not been too uplifting. I was supposed to go out to dinner with my friend Alan that night. He's one of my very good friends, though I don't know if his name is spelled A-L-A-N or A-L-L-A-N. I also have major questions about how to spell his last name. I was jet-lagged and having some hardcore back pain from all the travel, so I booked a massage. I walked out of the hotel spa feeling great, generally excited about life, fortunate, and rejuvenated. I looked at my cell phone and had a lot of missed calls from my publicist, Carrie, who'd also sent me many texts telling me to call her right away. I started giggling. If she was trying to contact me that urgently, I was certain that a naked photo or a sex tape of me must have gotten out. I had sex with my boyfriend on a computer camera once when I was 20, and it was totally awful. We were in no way focused on each other. We were looking at ourselves on the monitor. I'd bought black lacy lingerie with a garter belt. I didn't understand that you have to be a Victoria's Secret model to not look insane in a getup like that. A still of Rupert Murdoch in a rocking chair would have looked sexier than I did in that outfit. All in all, it was a horrible sight, and I apologize in advance for that sex tape in case it ever does get out. I have major, major sympathy for anyone whose phone or computer has ever been hacked, and I really hope it never happens to me. But nude photos don't scare me. I'm sure they will leak someday, and I don't know how I'll feel then. But on this particular day, at this particular moment in my life, I think I'd laugh if it happened, and apologize to all who had to see the footage or shots. So on July 23rd, 2015, I was preparing myself for news of my sex tape leaking and was gearing up to calm down my publicist and let her know I didn't care. I dialed Carrie, and I was already smiling. My giggling had become a full laugh by the time she answered. Then she said, there was a shooting in a theater in Lafayette, Louisiana, at a showing of Trainwreck. My heart broke right then and there. I mean it. The only other times I felt sadness that heavy in my life were after a surfing accident when I was sure I was losing my leg, and upon hearing of the deaths of a couple close friends. The news crushed me. I went to my hotel room, turned on CNN, and became almost catatonic. I didn't yet know that two beautiful, smart, strong women would die that night. I didn't know about Macy Brough, who was just 21 years old and a sweet, kind, gorgeous, church-going girl who was set to marry her high school sweetheart. And I didn't know about Jillian Johnson. She was just 33 years old and an active member in her community. A great wife and stepmother. She was a smart and creative business owner, a musician, and a beautiful artist. I needed to know every detail, and I wanted to fly straight to Louisiana to be with the families who were affected by this tragedy. My friend Alan came over to my hotel room and let me put my head on his lap while I cried. He called the necessary people and took care of me. I was pretty out of it for a couple weeks. I had more press to do for Trainwreck and a vacation planned with friends, but I wanted to cancel everything. I read about the disturbed man who killed Macy and Jillian and injured 9 other people. I don't believe in giving mass shooters their moment in the sun. I don't want to write his name. I never have and never will say it. But I do want to outline some facts about him. He loved the Tea Party. He publicly hated women and praised Hitler. This man purposefully selected my movie as a place to shoot and kill women. Here are a few other facts. In 2006, he was arrested for arson and was denied a concealed weapons permit in Russell County, Alabama, as a result. Though the arson charges were eventually dropped. In 2008, his family members asked a court to involuntarily commit him for mental health treatment because he was a danger to himself and others. But he was only committed on an emergency basis and never reached the stage of having a judge rule on his mental competence. Also in 2008, his former intimate partner filed a protective order against him, but no final order was issued by the court. Despite all that, in February 2014, he was able to legally buy a gun in a Phoenix City, Alabama pawn shop, the gun that would become his murder weapon. He was not prohibited from having guns, but he was precisely the type of person who should be barred. A person with a dangerous criminal history who abused and threatened family members, and who had contacts with the mental health system. Several states have passed laws often referred to as gun violence restraining orders, which allow family members of these types of dangerous people to ask a court to temporarily prohibit the person from having guns. If granted, not only do these orders prohibit the person from buying a gun, but they also require the person to turn in the guns they already own. Had this tool been available to this man's family members when he threatened them, maybe everything would have turned out differently for Macy and Jillian. Knowing this is unbearable. Knowing this is enough to make me want to do something. And yet gun violence restraining orders are just the tip of the iceberg. Because even if every single state had more laws like this in place to keep guns out of dangerous hands, there's still a gaping loophole that makes it easy for anyone to buy guns through unlicensed sellers, perhaps at gun shows or online. Because for those sales, there are no background checks and no questions asked. Surveys conducted over 3 decades consistently show that 30 to 40% of U.S. gun transfers take place without a background check. In many states, getting a gun is easier than getting birth control. Read on. It gets even better. Worse. In several states in this country, it's legal to buy a gun if you're completely blind. And in most states, it's legal to buy a gun if you're on a terror watch list. I'm going to tell you that again. If you can't see anything at all, you can buy a gun. If you're on not just the no-fly list, but literally the list of people our government suspects are terrorists, you can legally buy a gun. Don't get it twisted. I'm great friends with plenty of gun owners. I believe law-abiding Americans have every right to own a gun. But I think there is room for improvement. Don't you? Haven't enough shootings happened? You know who says no? The people who profit the most from gun sales. But 92% of Americans, including 82% of gun owners and 74% of NRA members, support criminal background checks for all gun sales. Yet the gun lobby opposes this most common sense of policies. And their lapdogs in Congress, whom they've bought and paid for, fall in lockstep behind them. As you may have noticed by now, there are a lot of lists in this book. I've included another one in a PDF with this audiobook. It's a list of congresspeople who've taken money from and been influenced by the gun lobby. Enjoy. It was especially striking to me to learn that gun violence is specifically a woman's issue. Women in America are 11 times more likely to be murdered with guns than women in other developed nations. In the 18 states that require background checks for all handgun sales, 46% fewer women are shot and killed by intimate partners than in the states that do not. Do you know much about all of this? Before the Lafayette shooting, I didn't. You owe it to yourself and your family to be educated about it, because it's a problem we can chip away at, together. For more details on how to get involved, see the PDF. As I've documented in this book, I've mostly been able to find the humor in the absolute darkest moments. It's hard to do that with this, though. I know that for many of you, this might not be a chapter you signed up for, and you may be thinking, get back to telling your vagina jokes. Make us laugh, clown. I hear you. When I've written sketches about gun safety on my TV show, people have responded by saying they wish I'd just be funny. They tell me to stick to comedy, because that's what they come to me for. I'll tell you what I tell them. No! I love making people laugh, and I'm grateful that I'm equipped to do that. But when an injustice affects me deeply, I will speak about it, and I suggest you do the same. I wish I could muster the energy to put a clever and sarcastic spin on some of the grave statistics about gun violence in America. But I have to tell you, I just fucking can't. I was able to write a funny scene about gun safety on my TV show this year. And if you want to laugh along, please watch. But for this chapter in my book, I'm not laughing. I think about Macy and Jillian every day. I carry pictures of them on the road with me, and when I see that yet another American or several Americans were killed senselessly and avoidably by guns, all I can think is enough is a fucking enough, period. I began working with Senator Chuck Schumer, a distant cousin of my father's, to advocate for sensible ways to stop gun violence. I sit on a committee for Everytown, a movement of Americans working together to end gun violence and build safer communities. As I was drafting this chapter, no lie, I got an invitation to the White House to meet President Obama and was there when he announced a set of new executive actions to address this national crisis. The White House allowed me to bring a few guests, so I brought my sister, my brother, and Ben. There are few people I'd drop everything and fly across the country for on such little notice. President Obama is one of them. Common and Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black are two others. What I'm saying is, it was thrilling to get to be there. We were joined by the rapper Wale and two guys from the Washington Wizards basketball team who are advocates to end gun violence. I was hanging out with them for most of the visit. When it was time for the president to come into the room to meet us, we formed a receiving line. I straightened the wizard's ties and belt and then saw that I had some dirt on my leg, so I quickly licked my finger and rubbed it off because I am as elegant as I am hygienic. We were all transformed into little kids helping each other on picture day. As we neared the president, we were asked to write our name and occupation on a fancy little card and hand it to a stoic naval officer so he could announce us to the president before we shook his hand. When it was my turn, the officer looked at what I'd written on my card and, without missing a beat, announced with military precision, "Amy Schumer, she is a model." I stepped forward and President Barack Obama smiled at me. We shook hands and he spoke first. "You're very funny, Amy Schumer." He sounded just like he sounds on TV. "So are you." "We really enjoyed Trainwreck," he said. I said, "You saw Trainwreck?" He nodded and said, "Of course." I couldn't believe it. He was so cool. He was keeping the conversation going with me, and I didn't want to take any more of his time, so I rushed our picture together. I was losing my mind in the picture, so moved and thrilled. He thanked me for my work trying to end gun violence, and I thanked him back and walked into the room where the press conference would take place. A bit later, the president faced the cameras, standing in front of the parents of children whose lives were taken by gun violence, many from the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. He delivered the most eloquent, honest speech I will ever hear. He talked about the first graders who were killed. He repeated the words, "first graders," and shed a few tears. I could see them. He wiped away the ones on his left side, but not the right. After a few beats, he wiped both eyes. He spoke about how it was all too easy to get firearms on the internet or at gun shows without a background check. Then he outlined the plan to fix that and much more. When the press conference was over, I stood in the room for a while and was approached by people wearing buttons with the picture of their slain children on them. Parents wearing their dead children on their lapels. They just wanted to tell me about their